Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And with Scott, as always, I'm Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 29th, 2025. All right, Tom, what do you got for us?
All right, first off this week, we got an article from Unit 42. It's titled Phantom Taurus, a new Chinese Nexus APT and the discovery of the NetStar malware suite. So Phantom Taurus is a newly designated Chinese aligned APT. The actor conducts long-term espionage operations with a focus on ministries, embassies, government service providers, and telecoms, especially in Africa, Middle East, and Asia. They're targeting maps to the PRC strategic interests. So we're looking at like the diplomatic defense, regional influence, and such. What distinguishes Phantom Taurus is a combination of rare or custom TTPs, especially a newly observed malware suite called NetStar. That's specifically tailored for IIS servers and .NET in-memory execution. Over time, the actor has expanded from email theft to direct database targeting via SQL scripts in the most recent observed campaigns. So some of the technical and TTP highlights here. So Phantom Taurus used a script, mssq.bat, to connect to SQL Server instances using the system admin account or the SA account and the known password to run arbitrary queries, export results to CSV, and then close out the connections. The attackers invoked that .bat file remotely via WMI to execute on target hosts. That indicates, you know, lateral movement or privilege escalation before the database access, with them being able to obtain like the SQL credentials. So kind of talking about that kind of newly found malware suite, the NetStar. This suite is a set of in-memory fileless .NET backdoors designed for operation under that IIS environment. There are three core components to this. So the II server core, which is a modular memory resistant backdoor that lives inside the IIS worker, that w3wp.exe, after being loaded via a web shell loader. It supports arbitrary commands, payloads, and has built-in C2 communication encrypted over HTTP channels. It includes a change last modified command. So it looks like, you know, a lot of efforts to actively timestamp some of the files or file metadata to kind of potentially obfuscate the forensic timelines or detections. The backdoor logic is broken into 11 methods. Some of the helper methods include base64, encrypt, decrypt, compression via gzip, and then AES encryption, decryption, context parsing. The backdoors also supports a rich command set. So some of the things that we see here, I won't go through the whole list, but you see things like being able to, you know, create lists, read files, delete files, run code, add additional shells, things like that. The second component of the NetStar malware is the assembly executor version 1, or V1. That's a .NET in-memory loader. It accepts a .NET assembly as input, and it uses the assembly load call, then executes the entry point with the various arguments. Because it doesn't write to disk, it often does evade many detection AV tools. And you have the assembler executor V2. So this basically just builds on top of that V1's functionality, but adds the abilities to bypass both AMSI, so the anti-malware scan interface, and then the event tracing for Windows. The bypass logic is parameterized. The malware picks which bypass methods to apply depending on the environment. So worth noting. So some of the persistence and stealth techniques we're looking at here. So the use of the web shells, the ASPX, they have a specific Outlook en.aspx, which embeds a base64 compressed version of that II server core module in the NetStar malware. The web shell and backdoor binaries are again timestamped. The compilation timestamps are also manipulated to kind of additionally mask those true build times. And then again, all payloads are running in memory. No component needs to drop a permanent executable on the disk. And that really does complicate that ability to detect. And, you know, kind of looking at some of the other pieces here that were kind of mentioned, this new group new actor, they are leveraging common tools as well. So, you know, we're looking at things like Impact, PlugX. They're also leveraging the China Chopper and Ghost Rat, as well as various SMB tooling. You know, really, Scott, this one is, it's relatively meaty, but it's also kind of, this one provides, and I'm curious of your thoughts on it, a lot of gaps because of how this functions. So there's not an overwhelming amount of ways to kind of really go after this as relative to some of the typical things that we do talk about. I still think there are some, you know, levels here that you can kind of really kind of look at to target for Hunt. So when they talk about that IIS worker process, so that W3WP.exe, looking at, you know, launching suspicious child processes or unexpected network connections, that's one thing that I definitely looked at. I do have some notes here for, you know, additional kind of tracing for the time stomping. I think we've seen a few articles in the past month or so, 2 months maybe, that talked about the use of time stomping. And then also one that I think is probably the lowest hanging fruit is when you can look and detect for that AMSI or that the ETW bypass behavior. I think those things have been used quite a bit before, and we've talked about them, but those are just a couple kind of low hanging fruits I had from this. All in all, it seems like you know, a new player on the block. We do see a lot of check boxes with combinations of tools being used, techniques being used, and also apparent collaboration with other groups. But yeah, I'll take a breath, see what you thought of this one, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I like was kind of how they visualize the very top as far as, you know, they're tracking this activity cluster, they call it, they kind of give it a temporary name because it may or may not be a group or a fully dedicated group to something. And then when they start seeing it more like formally operated and stuff, then they give it the group name, Phantom Taurus. I like that because I feel like people, especially that are kind of new to the concept of like what a threat actor group is, we just associate it with like a true entity or a person. But sometimes, you know, people operate in different groups, for instance, so they can move around, especially in the criminal underground. So activities sometimes follow them. So seeing a change in activity is, when you define a group, is really more about the activity than it is the persona sometimes. So, and it also helps when it comes to defending, if you think of it more of an activity, a collection of activities versus a specific person or, you know, individuals, I think it makes it easier to defend too, because as they change, because technology, time, skill sets change, you won't be like focused on the wrong things because you're kind of trying to put everything together. So I like that breakout, as I like to call that out. The other thing that stood out to me was, you know, you had this script interpreter training stuff going on. You have, you know, CMD kicking off PowerShell. And the one thing that's nice, because in this instance, I believe in the bat file that CMD is launching, it's launching PowerShell from the bat file. And if I'm sure there may be a way, but I see that if you're going to launch PowerShell from a bat file, you usually, or the simplest way is you're providing the dash C argument. So you're putting the whole command that you're passing to PowerShell in the bat file, which also means that that full command will be logged. So it's something worth paying attention to. One, you know, in this case, it's a really long command. So length could be almost a determiner for, hey, this might be interesting. But another thing, since they're trying to interact with a SQL database, you know, a lot of database admins, I don't believe, use PowerShell to interact with their databases and things. They have dedicated tool sets and software typically to make that a lot easier. So, but PowerShell does have built-in objects, right? You see an example here when it has, you know, system data SQL client, right? .SQL connection. Like, there are SQL S objects that PowerShell can call to do that kind of interaction. I think it's worth looking for that in general and understanding, is that even being used in your environment? Because obviously adversaries, when they don't have the same tool sets or aren't sitting in the same spot, that's one way for them to interact with a SQL database, especially if they have credentials to gain access. The other thing you called out with like the different child processes from W3WP, because they do have a web shell on IIS. They didn't have examples of specifically like it chaining to execute something, but most commonly that's how that's done. So that will be the parent process of any of the things it launches. So that's always a good thing to pay attention to. So I think those are two strong things associated with this specific group. And then they did call out some like the discovery stuff. I thought maybe I'm thinking of the other one. I'm thinking about the other one. But yeah, so those are like the two key points I'd be paying attention to, as well as just kind of paying attention to what is their goal to kind of sit and be persistent, or like get in and get stuff and get out. It feels more like a persistence based on some of their like mini capabilities, especially with the footholds they're getting. So yeah, I mean, it's a good write up. I think there's some things you kind of dig out that they don't really like harp on, but there's some good artifacts and things to think about in this to, I think, really help get you off the ground for looking for some stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And some of those, you know, there's, I've taken some, taken a little bit of liberty too, just like you had mentioned, to some of the capabilities that they do talk on, they kind of gap on the specifics of how they're used. But when you kind of put the context together, the rest of the article, it's like, yeah, this seems like the most likely way that this is occurring, right? Because we see that commonly, or it's commonly leveraged that way. So yeah. Right, what do you got next for, Scott?
Yeah. So I reached a little further back because I want to talk about it. And it was more about how, you know, there are some interesting things, even though it's not called out in the article specifically. And this was a Trend Micro blog, and it's titled "The New Lockbit 5.0 Targets Windows, Linux, and ESXi." I can't remember if the previous version of Lockbit targeted ESXi. I'd be surprised if it didn't, but that is something that they're specifically calling out here. But obviously, they had samples, right, that they can run. And just like a lot of tools native to systems, there's the help command, right? So what they displayed in their article is if they're going to run the Lockbit binary with the -h or whatever for the help for options, or maybe they just put it in brackets for options. But either way, it showed all the arguments that can be passed. It even has good descriptions of what those actually mean. And it even has examples for how you can run it. If you know, at first it's kind of like, well, what can I do with this? For instance, and obviously it is kind of really late in the attack chain to be looking for these types of executions. But depending on what environment potentially is hit and identifying something quickly, you might be able to turn some of these things into detections. Like the things I was focusing on was, what are some weird, characters and argument combinations that I wouldn't expect to see or would be considered rare from a command line perspective? Because, you know, heaven forbid, if the sample gets compiled in a certain way that it gets past all your detections and all your endpoint stuff, you'd still want to know that something is being run. And if something's putting in command line arguments, they may still have direct access to your environment. So, you know, it's worth, I guess, being aware of or notifying with a detection. So in this case, one of the things I was paying attention to was they have ways where you can basically use arguments, and arguments are slightly different for the Linux version and the ESXi version, but to list either what directories you want to encrypt or what directories you want to bypass and not encrypt, but they use a semicolon for separation. And so that was the thing that kind of stood out to me a little bit was, oh, okay. So, you know, you've got, semicolons aren't common in command lines from what I've seen. And even with some of the testing and stuff I've been looking at, there are some things that will use it that looks kind of like that. But I think it's probably an easier exclusion than you might think. So it was something that I was kind of playing with, and it wasn't something that was directly called out, because literally the whole article walks through the different options, the capabilities, what the different variants look like. They do talk about some of like the sizes and kind of how it's encoded, and the commonality of the code being brought from previous versions of Lockbit. But yeah, and if you look at the Linux version, it kind of the same thing. they have their examples, they have things being semicolon separated, and they have different arguments for how they call out what they're looking for. But the last piece that I thought was actually interesting, and this is, I think, a big dead giveaway, where they have capabilities, right, listed for the ESXi, just like they do all the options for the Windows and Linux variants. But obviously, with the virtualization environment, there is additional options, right? Do you want to automatically kill VMs? Do you want to skip VMs? That kind of thing. And in it, they provide basically a command you can run on the ESXi to list the VM IDs that you would then use, right? And I think that's a really good call out, because obviously, if you need to list the VMs and figure out which ones you want to kill, and you're providing that guidance, and someone gets their hands on this and they want to use it, or whatever it looks like, there's a good chance they'll actually run that command to list the VMs, because they're kind of following the tutorial, so to speak, of the actual binary. So the fact they're putting commands and system commands in their help doc for their binaries, I think is a good use for looking for that kind of behavior. Not saying that you won't see it, because I'm sure administrators can do the same thing, but a lot of, like, this specific command they show here is the vim-cmd, which is kind of like that bash-like interface for ESXi. You can get to it, you can run the same command via SSH. And then it's the vmsvc/get-all-vms is one word, and that basically will display all the IDs that way. So it's obviously going to be a precursor to when encryption actually happens. So in this case, you might be able to potentially get ahead, depending on how quick you move, looking and responding to that. But it's still some artifacts that, you know, I think are worth paying attention to. How much ground will you gain? You know, I'm always on that fence of like, well, do we want to detect some ransomware hits, because it's kind of too late? But from a response perspective, it'd be nice to know what parts of your environment are hit, because you can see that easier than waiting for someone to report it, or systems or services going offline, just by seeing the activity. So I think it can have a better coordinated response. Also, earliest indicators, even when things happen, people are usually still in the environment. So then you kind of have this, well, what other things should we be either protecting immediately, or, you know, responding to try to remove access to what you think may be compromised. So, yeah, so it's like not a very in-depth article as far as really giving you TTPs and things like we're used to seeing. But, you know, just by looking at screenshots and kind of understanding the content, I still think you can still, you know, pull out interesting nuggets that could help you. And that's kind of what I want to call out in bringing this one up specifically. So I don't know what your takeaway was, because it's not our usual like walkthrough of like an attack or whatever. But yeah, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, the first thing that I hit here was I threw an idea at a whiteboard, and I was like, you know, I wonder, and I'm looking at all these commands, and maybe it's the way the article was written and it got me in the human function, but I was curious, because initially I thought, I was like, well, you know, a lot of these commands, or a lot of the flags for the commands are relative to common flags. But then I was like, wait, you know, I started doing a little bit of looking to see, what about the combinations of them? Is there a way to potentially look at, you know, hunting this kind of activity? And again, this is stepping aside from your point of, you know, is alerting on ransomware after it's already taken place kind of a thing. But I was curious about it a little bit, and it, you know, turns out some of the combination of like, you know, like the -m-k type of look inside of a command line, like those, some of these combinations relative to this were pretty rare. Some were very common, so like trying to flag or look at individual ones like that would be tricky. But mostly in particular around the Linux side, you know, because a lot of flags are leveraged from the command line utilities there. But yeah, that was the first thing I thought, Scott, because I thought it was just an interesting little, you know, mind game theory in my head. Like, oh, I wonder what I could potentially develop just thinking about it from that light. So I figured I'd share that relative to this.
Yeah, ransomware is always that tough one, because you really care about what the people do, not so much what the ransomware does. But in some instances, it's not bad to at least feel you have an idea how they operate, or the malware itself operates, so that, you know, you're not kind of in the blind in case you miss everything else.
If anything, I could see this more being a bit of helping you feed to attribution versus anything, right? Because you would think you're already kind of pwned. But being able to see some of this activity, you could at least attribute it and maybe get some grip on protecting the rest of your environment or minimizing the damage.
Yeah, especially if you have to root somebody out. Like if you haven't found the initial compromise, but you know how maybe the lockbit group, I guess. I assume lockbit's actually used by multiple entities because I feel like it's shared, but
yeah,
you know, in that perspective though. So yeah, what do you got for us next?
All right, next one on my list is an article from Zscaler. It's titled Cold Driver Adds Bait Switch and Simple Fix. So Zscaler's Threat Labs reports a newer campaign by the Russian linked APT group Cold Driver. They're also known as Star Blizzard, Callisto, or UNC 4057. They're focusing on civil society targets, so think NGOs, think tanks, activists, things like that. The reported campaign uses a click-fix social engineering trick to coerce victims to run a malicious command via the Windows Run dialog. That's leveraging that to deliver the bait switch, the downloader for the bait switch, and subsequently the backdoor simple fix. Click-fix, we've talked about many times before. It's definitely not novel, but continues to be effective. So threat actors continue to use it because, of its reliance on the human behavior rather than like the pure technical exploits. The campaign includes server-side checks to selectively deliver malicious payloads only to targets matching certain conditions. So a lot that they talked about or one they referenced specifically is they're looking for very specific user agent filters. So very much targeted and capable of being targeting. And then that also helps reduce the detection, by kind of like a generic diffusion, if you will. So some of the technical pieces on this one, the click fix social engineering side, landing page mimics a resource for civil society, think tank communities, and presents that fake Cloudflare turnstile CAPTCHA like checkbox, things that we've seen before. User clicks, the embedded JavaScript copies a malicious run DLL32.exe command into the clipboard. Then it prompts the user to paste execute in the Windows Run dialog, stuff we've seen before. I've talked about in abundance. Once clicked, the victim is redirected to a decoy document on Google Drive to mask the malicious activity. And then as the bait switch downloader is brought on, it enforces a specific user agent string before the server responds with the payloads, as I had mentioned. It does make 5 HTTP requests to CAPTCHA nom.top endpoints. I'm not even going to try to butcher the names of some of these 5 requests specifically about their tag, but I will read through them. I'll just mark them 1 through 5. So the first one we see, which is an instruction to establish persistence by modifying that the user init MPR logon script registry key to run a PowerShell script on user logon. The second one stores AES encrypted Base64 encoded payload and key into registry keys, specifically under the enthusiast mod and QAT items, and they're doing this via PowerShell. The third one, it will actually download the PowerShell stager and drop it under the Microsoft Windows directory. The fourth one will clear the run MRU registry key, aiming to remove evidence or traces of that that win plus R dialog box pasting of that command, which I found interesting. That's something I don't think we've talked about or considered before, so we'll come back to that in a minute. Then the last one sends out the host name and the victim identification pieces out to the C2. So the PowerShell stager, the second part of this, the simple fix and the simple fix backdoor, on the next user login, the PowerShell script will run with the command line parameters. It uses obfuscation techniques, so several Base64 encoded strings, decoded, concatenated, transformed, a whole gamut of trying to hide itself. And then the final backdoor, that simple fix backdoor, is delivered, which is a PowerShell-based implant controlled by the actor directly. It's lightweight, tended to be stealthy, and gives stealthy command and control operations and capabilities to the actor. So, the bait switch and C2 infrastructure, they only respond to the requests that have the precise specific user agent string. The initial landing page may detect the environment so the browser platform, and withhold payloads if the suspect is a sandbox or an analysis environment. So it does have some anti-sandbox capabilities. And then again, you know, back to that, this one, Scott, that deleting that run MRU key to kind of remove those traces. You know, really, I kind of want to ask and stop there. There's definitely some things to hit on here that you can consider for the hunt piece. But I was curious, have you ever looked into that, Scott, yourself, of what kind of telemetry might be around that? Especially when we're talking ClickFix, I can't remember if we specifically discussed this one or not, but the telemetry around modifying or editing that key to try to remove those traces, that was a little new from my brain, but I'm curious what you thought.
Yeah, I mean, some of the forensic stuff that I've done in the past, that was a common thing to basically determine what were some of the last things that were open or interacted with. So it's interesting to really expect to use that from, like, if there's a compromise. I mean, I guess it would be helpful if you think someone's phished and they kind of went through that, where the user is kind of driving a lot of the behavior. But a lot of times I feel like it's, if you're investigating the user themselves, it's a very powerful telemetry just to get the kind of like the current state or latest state of what they were doing or how they were using their machine, kind of thing, or what they're accessing. So the fact that they're actually deleting that, I think, is just really interesting, because it's not seen a lot. I mean, I know in the past adversaries have done that, but it's just not a common place they go. But it also leads to their understanding of the system, right? Because I don't think a lot of people think about that key, especially like from the, you know, criminal side of the house. I feel like it usually isn't a place that's touched. So that was interesting. I also think it was interesting because the seeing the run DLL kind of running something not local, I wasn't 100% certain you could do that, but they make it look like you can from the data they provided, where it's actually running a DLL that it's basically getting from the captionom.top. If I'm reading that correctly, it's what you know, they get you to paste to your clipboard. So I thought that was also interesting, using run DLL in that way, versus the other types of ClickFix stuff, that we have seen. Obviously they have like a lot of, you know, traditional, like the hidden PowerShell, you know, execution bypass, all that kind of stuff. The other thing that I think is worth paying attention to, that is a little different was, you know, the stager, it the way it modified the CLS IDs in the registry for the software, Microsoft Windows current version Explorer. And the reason why I say that is usually your CLS IDs are almost like the registry's version of what's installed software, or installed software's functionality that other software can then call and use. It usually kind of associates with COM objects and things, just kind of how the system natively works, right? So a lot of times I would not expect this CLS ID registries to be edited by arbitrary executables, for instance, like if it's being modified by PowerShell or, you know, WScript or whatever, I would think that would be intriguing, right? So I think it's worth paying attention to when those get modified. Now, I do know that we have turned on logging for those in the past, and if you just watch CLS IDs in general, it will create a lot of noise, like a lot, because there's some things that just get tracked in there. They are constantly getting updated from applications perspective. But like I said, if you're able to kind of exclude the known talkers, known updaters with that list, I think you'd actually have a pretty powerful way to look for this. And all they're storing in there is an encrypted PowerShell, right? So they're even just dropping that. And sometimes, depending on what it is, even if you look at key length, if that's something you're able to actually measure from either your logging or, you know, if you actively go to systems and run certain things to pull that data back, key length sometimes can tell you that it might be encoded or encrypted script in the registry as well. So those are things to kind of look for that may be beneficial. And then at the bottom, they go through they have really good artifacts. as far as like what they ran and what they did. The big thing for me, I was thinking about this in the earlier article you brought up, but it was the blurt of discovery commands, because they're all appended after each other, right? As if it's just one big command to just dump everything. Things like that run in succession that fast is very questionable, because unless there's like a some sort of system management software, it's kind of always doing checks and using those in that manner, which once again, you can kind of whitelist some of the executions there or add that to an exclusion. It's kind of a telltale sign there's something going on in the system on the earlier stages of things, right? So, yeah, those are some of the key things that stood out to me initially.
Yeah, for sure. A couple of quick call-outs for passing over to you for the last one. There was definitely some common ones that we do see too. So one specific one is the running PowerShell, running those hidden windows, or there's those bypass executions, as well as the the PowerShell commands to kind of like use that invoke web request to go out and pull
the download stuff from.
Those are pretty low hanging fruit typically, but definitely things worth noting. But yeah, I'll pass it over to you, Scott, for the last one of the day.
I guess the last note too, if they're running everything with a PowerShell -C, that means there's also multiple instances of PowerShell they're going to be running in that short period of time, which also can be questionable, right? If you just see PowerShell, and then if it's all coming from especially the same parent, that might be another thing to, bring some light to.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. Well, the last one, this one, it's not so much, I would say, technical. It's just something that I wanted to highlight that I think happens. But it's a HelpNet security article. They're kind of talking about the Akira ransomware. So they're doing the coverage that's been talked about by a few different groups. And it's from SonicWall VPN login to encryption in under 4 hours. So Arctic Wolf did research, has been kind of tracking some of the Akira activity, and that's kind of what they call out. And they kind of summarized everything here. And, the biggest thing, right, they kind of walk through their summarization. When Akira got on the network, they started scanning, did discovery stuff, looking for unsecured accounts as well. They used MPacket to basically create SMB sessions. They used RDP for lateral movement when they had credentials. They found their way to domain controller. They gained access to virtual machine storage and backups. So they're able to get more data just because virtual machine sometimes holds information and protects it pretty well, but it's easily readable. They create additional accounts in the domain, and they install their own remote management software, which we've seen, a lot. So like a lot of these things are high level, but we've talked about them in depth with covering other ransomware groups. They kind of all follow the same pattern. They established their C2 method. They collected an exfil data, right? But they did disable legitimate remote management tools and obviously EDR tools, and that makes sense. I thought disabling legitimate remote management tools was an interesting step, because I feel like they could tip their hat by doing that, depending on how those tools are being leveraged. If they're just for like service support, so if no one complains, no one's using them, or if they're like used by admins and system admins across the network. And then they did the typical deleting the shadow volumes, clearing logs, moves, which, a lot of people should be at least paying attention to. But they did install WinRAR, and they use that to archive the data and exfiltrate it. And they exfiltrate it with rclone. So another common thing to see is rclone has very specific arguments that are easy to identify. And then also, if you're not in an environment that uses WinRAR, it's always worth paying attention to WinRAR, because WinRAR seems to be more of a popular compression archive tool in like the European West Asian area. So seeing stuff like that dropped or leveraged can be questionable, because there's a lot of groups that function out of those areas. And then obviously they deployed their ransomware. But the piece I wanted to call out here was how the attackers got in. And, you know, they call out that, yes, they believe they used the SonicWall, or they did, I think, confirm they used the SonicWall VPN device kind of vulnerability that was CVE 2024 and it's numbered 40766. And it just comes back to that culture. For one, it's so long ago that vulnerability is there. You have something on the edge, you know, if you didn't patch it or address it, you know, you're kind of opening yourself up and it's kind of easy, right? But the other thing is, when I was digging into this, they really believe that because the vulnerability allowed access to local credentials on that SonicWall, if you just patched it, but you didn't change or roll anything, then that's what they did in a lot of instances. They believe is they had credentials that worked from a previous kind of breach that then leveraged later, or maybe they bought them from someone else, or, you know, however that exchange was, but they had those valid local credentials in order to take advantage of this. And I bring that up because if you actually read the CVE from SonicWall, their recommendations specifically say, you know, patch, you know, whatever, but roll local credentials as a, you know, just to make sure you're covered on that avenue. And apparently that wasn't followed. And I feel like sometimes we move so fast, right? Especially if you're just managing something and you already hate patching things because things could break, and you have to schedule it to go through this whole process and rigmarole. So a lot of times you're just trying to figure out how to get through it with the least pain points as possible. And if you can just get the patch in place, you can say you're patched. And what's great is, sure, then you can use whoever's managing vulnerabilities. They can do their tool and they can check you off and say, yep, we're golden. Everything looks green. But you really didn't do the right thing by not following all the steps and recommendations provided, right? If you didn't roll the accounts like they were recommended, if you didn't understand the vulnerability and the level of impact it had, if you were impacted by it, how to protect yourself moving forward. Those are always actions as a security person. You kind of got to be careful when it comes to checking the box. Like, there's good hygiene, you know, muscle memory moves you do to secure a network, to keep up to date on things. But sometimes don't get caught up, I guess, and just kind of going with the motions, you know, because I feel like that's what actually got these victims from Akira here. So that was the biggest thing I really want to call out. Like, when it comes to CVEs and patching is obviously the first step, but it sometimes is worth digging in and looking at recommendations for the CVE, looking at what the actually, you know, what can occur. Because, for instance, you know, we threat hunt, and a lot of times we're looking for those post-exploitation activity from a CVE. And if the CVE allows someone to drop something that then became a hook that way, so then you patch it, it doesn't matter, they already have access. It's kind of the same step, right? You're always paying attention to what, you know, what are some of the later on effects of this, not just the vulnerable facing stuff. So yeah, what were your thoughts? I know I kind of rambled a little bit, but that was kind of the point I wanted to cover.
No, I mean, it's a good point. I'm glad you made it so I didn't have to, but that was one of the first things I seen. You know, and I think it's too, Scott, like in real world instances, and I'm going to speak from a stool of a little bit of ignorance here from the SonicWall setup or the given environments. But, you know, when you do kind of do the patches, you do potentially roll the creds. I could also see that, you know, a mistake being made where people think, well, this account isn't here anymore, or this account's not been used for X amount of time or something like that. And they're only looking at rolling accounts that have been used in a given time frame. You know, stuff like that. If you don't have some kind of a policy to actively roll those, and you take that approach, because those, you know, when you're talking about the muscle memory for how you're going to protect a given environment, considering those things, we tend to fall into those muscle memories fast. And, you know, really thinking about them a little more distinctively is required in a lot of cases. I think especially when you're talking about considering your web of what you're open for and your vulnerabilities, right? So, you know, I can see how a simple mistake like, okay, well, we're going to roll the creds for any account that's been active in the past 6 months. Well, what if them credentials were stolen 7 months ago, right? Small things like that I can see as being the, you know, just the little needle in a haystack that ends up costing you a compromise, right? But yeah, you know, I don't want to keep echoing a lot of what you had said because you already stole some of the thunder. But one thing I did want to note too, though, like back to Akira, because they've been kind of on the uptick more recently, and I've had to spend some time looking at them myself. It was interesting to see in this one where they talked about this disabling legitimate remote management tools, because in other instances, they actually deploy remote, like common remote management tools like AnyDesk. So, it, you know, it's not necessarily surprising all the big ransomware groups to kind of have Swiss Army knife of a toolbox to be able to, you know, opportunity will allow them to take advantage of, right? So I found an open vulnerability. I have this little tool suite. I'm going to deploy the things that work. So I'm going to get in, get out, you know, cash the check and move on to the next, right? Mm-hmm. But it is interesting, and it was interesting that that was the cause through all of this. And the article time talking about how I was able to kind of access and encrypt within 4 hours, like, well, if you have the creds, that's pretty easy to do, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, the question is I didn't really get into it and I didn't dig much further, but are the local creds that are used elsewhere? Because usually that really expedites sharing. Yeah. So cred reuse on top of just not understanding and rolling things when they need to be. And, you know, that's something we've encountered, I think, historically in our life, is rolling passwords sometimes can be hard, but it doesn't have to be. But having good documentation is really, really important. Because it should be as simple as just following steps 1 through 3 or whatever, you know?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I really want to thank everyone for joining this week's Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. Looking forward to syncing up back next week. And with that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 29th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.